Women and children killed in northern Mexico. Questions remain about whether they were targeted and what happens next. Today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. That massacre in Mexico, an example of the violence asylum seekers from the country say they need to get away from. We'll have a report. Plus, the state's most populous county had big delays in election results, a dispute over who and what is to blame. And something you do every day could be contributing to the population decline of monarch butterflies. We'll explain that and more coming up on today's Texas Standard. No matter where you are, you're listening to the best radio program, at least as chosen by readers for the Austin Chronicle for, by my count, 4 years in a row now. Thanks, y'all. This is the Texas Standard for Thursday, November 7th. I'm Laura Rice. Weather is one big story in the Lone Star State today, with rain in the forecast from El Paso to Texarkana. A cold front also pushing down temperatures in much of the state. Check out the difference a day makes in high temperatures across Texas. A high of 76 yesterday in Odessa, today 46. In Arlington yesterday, 77. Today, 58. Tomorrow, 51. And in Laredo today, 86. Tomorrow, 58. Counties in the Texas Panhandle around Amarillo under winter weather advisories, with warnings of freezing fog and drizzle and the possibility of some very slick roads. Meanwhile, across our southern border, Mexican military escorts for members of the extended families of the women and children killed in a brutal attack in northern Mexico Monday. 3 women and 6 children murdered. Another 8 children able to escape, though some seriously wounded. Angela Cocherga is an El Paso-based reporter. She has been following this story for the Albuquerque Journal and has spoken to members of the extended family. Angela, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thank you, Laura.
What is the latest in this investigation? Yesterday we heard a suspect was in custody, but something has changed with that?
Yeah, so Mexican authorities said they had a suspect arrested with high-powered weapons and 2 hostages, but later said that this man was not connected to the massacre in northern Mexico of the women and children.
So what do we know about this family, the Les Barons, a longtime binational family of Mormons, I guess?
Yeah, so they are Le Baron or Le Baron, depending on which side of the border you're talking to the family. They are binational, bicultural, dual citizens, and they have been living in Mexico for generations. They left the U.S., kind of broke away from the Mormon church and left the U.S. when polygamy was outlawed. And so some in the early days continued to practice what they called plural marriage, but that since has, it's very rare. So it's a fundamentalist group, very close-knit, large extended family. Have a community, actually named for their ancestors, Le Baron, in Mexico and Chihuahua, about 190 miles south of the border from where I am, El Paso, and then another community in Sonora called La Mora, which is about 70 miles south of the Arizona border. So they've lived peacefully on and off with a few issues, but this really is something that has shocked and stunned family members who are in grief right now on both sides of the border.
So you call this region of northern Mexico lawless. It's in the middle of rival drug cartel territory. Do we know if these women and children were targeted or if this was a case of mistaken identity?
So this is disputed territory. They were traveling on a remote mountain road in an area that is, by all accounts, lawless. Originally, Mexican authorities said that it looked like they had been targeted, that the women and children were traveling in large SUVs in a caravan or convoy. But since then, I've spoken to relatives, and they tell me that the women were not all together, that this was carried out in 2 separate locations by gunmen who attacked the first woman with all her children. We've all seen that horrible video of the burned-out vehicle, but that they went after the other women in different locations and gunned them down. And there were, of course, some surviving children, and they hid in bushes while one of the 14-year-old actually walked for 14 miles to go and get help for his wounded siblings.
So perhaps even more disturbing that they targeted that first vehicle and then made the extra effort to go back after the other two, even if perhaps at that point they may have realized that there were women and children inside.
Yeah, so one of the women, one of the mothers, got out of her vehicle and identified herself to the gunman and ran around the back. She had the foresight before she left to put her baby, 7-month-old little girl, who was in a car seat on the floor of the SUV. She was killed in a hail of bullets. Now, that little child is one of the survivors. Mexican soldiers who were scouring the area found the vehicle, bullet-riddled vehicle, and the little girl named Faith, still strapped in her car seat, alive.
Oh, my goodness. Now, these murders, because of stories like that, of course, are getting a lot of attention on both sides of the border. President Trump tweeting, "This is the time for Mexico, with the help of the United States, to wage war on the drug cartels and wipe them off the face of the earth. We merely await a call from your great new president." What has been the response, though, from Mexican officials?
So Mexico's president said thanks, but no thanks, that his country would handle it. He said that previous presidents had tried military action and it had led to more bloodshed, so he was not going to get that kind of help. Mexico's foreign minister, though, traveled to the crime scene yesterday, and he said that the U.S. and Mexico will cooperate on the investigation in order to bring justice to this very, in his words, beloved binational community. So a lot of skepticism, though. There are lots of murders in the borderland region of northern Mexico that often go unsolved and unpunished. So real concern there. The families demanding justice, family members on both sides of the border who are headed to funerals this morning in La Mora to bury the women and children who were murdered.
Angela Cocherga is border reporter for the Albuquerque Journal. Angela, thank you so much.
Thank you, Laura.
A rise in violence in Mexico, demonstrated so starkly by that attack we were just talking about, has led a growing number of Mexicans to flee their homes and head to the U.S. border seeking asylum. But once they get to a port of entry, like other asylum seekers, they're blocked. A policy called metering limits the number of asylum seekers allowed into the U.S. each day. That leaves some Mexicans stuck in their own country, terrified the violence they're fleeing might catch up with them. From KERA North Texas, Mallory Falk reports from Ciudad Juarez.
Mexico's murder rate is on track to surpass last year's record high.
We have seen not only violence escalate across the country, but really spread out.
Jeremy Slack with UT El Paso studies migration and drug violence in Mexico.
The times when all of the fighting was concentrated in a place like Ciudad Juarez are over, and now we see conflicts flaring up in random cities throughout the country where the total amount of violence is much greater.
Several thousand Mexican asylum seekers have arrived in Juarez since June, many fleeing organized crime in states like Michoacán, Guerrero, and Zacatecas. But once they arrive, many have to wait. Dozens of tents line a small street near the Paso del Norte International Bridge. Some are covered with blankets or tarp as modest protection from the wind. An asylum seeker we're calling Maria sits on the curb, bundled into a soft hooded sweatshirt. She asked that we not use her real name.
Tengo un mes y medio ya aquí en la calle.
I've been out here on the street for a month and a half.
Maria says she left her hometown in Michoacán when a cartel began threatening her husband and killed his sister. Local authorities didn't offer protection.
Vas tú y pides ayuda y te dicen, pues no, no hay nada que hacer, estate callada, estate.
You ask for help and they'll tell you there's nothing to be done, just stay quiet. But how are you going to be calm if you know you're in danger? So that's when we decided, well, let's go.
Now Maria, her husband, and two sons are biding their time until it's their turn to cross the bridge and claim asylum. They're afraid to lose their spot on the waiting list, so they'd rather camp out here than look for other shelter. Similar scenes are playing out in Juarez at two other bridges and in a nearby park. Maria says so far, the wait's been monotonous.
Pues caminas hacia un lado, caminas hacia otro.
You walk to one side of the street, you walk to the other. For a while, you play with your kids.
But those kids quickly become restless.
There is literally not one single thing to do here on the street.
Christina Rathbone is a priest based in El Paso. She's started leading activities here for about an hour each afternoon.
Why not just teach them a class and have them dance and play and sing a bit at least, if not learn anything.
Today, Rathbone teaches the English words for body parts. No! She hands out chunks of pastel chalk. Children carefully sketch out eyes, noses, a row of sharp teeth. By the end of the lesson, the sidewalk is covered in art.
It's very little and it doesn't solve anything, but it also feels like what we can do.
Mexican asylum seekers, like Maria, are exempt from some of the Trump administration's new policies, primarily targeting Central Americans, like the Remain in Mexico program, but not metering, which started in full force about a year ago. Again, Jeremy Slack from UT El Paso.
If you're running or had issues with organized crime with drug cartels, the chances that those drug cartels have people in Juarez or work with people in Juarez are quite high. So the fact that you can be found in those places, you know, I think that's a huge danger that they're facing that other people aren't.
Maria knows that, but says she didn't have another option, and it's a risk she was willing to take.
Sí, es muy difícil, la verdad. Tanto cuidar a los niños, la comida.
It's very difficult, is the truth. Taking care of the kids, food, our costs. They charge you to use the bathroom. Sleeping in the cold, especially when the temperature drops, is difficult. But you try to bundle up and endure it.
Maria says she can only hope the wait is worth it. I'm Mallory Falk in Ciudad Juarez.
Time now to check in on what Texans are talking about with social media editor Wells Dunbar.
Hi, Laura. Texas Education Agency has notified Houston ISD that it will take over governance of the school board for now by installing its own set of trustees. Believe this to be the biggest so-called state takeover of a school district in the state up to now. The move wasn't unexpected, as the TEA has intimated as much for months following the continued failing performance of one Houston High School, plus its investigation into a school board that alleged Open Meetings Act violations and questionable contracting practices. But still, opponents, pointing to the district's overall B grade and financial health, call the move an overreaction. We're seeing lots of reactions coming in via Facebook.
I bet.
Yeah, on our Facebook page, Brian Jackson tells us that Houston ISD seriously needs help. But remember how the state illegally decreased funds for children with special needs and was fined millions of dollars by the feds for doing so? Let's see how they handle this. Again, Houston ISD needs intervention, Brian says, but will this work? I'll be monitoring Austin lawmakers' efforts. And pointing to the new school board election, which just transpired Tuesday, Election Day,
right,
where new school board members came afoot, Marla Wetherill McGee says it's not appropriate to replace publicly elected officials. This is frightening. Lots of people chiming in on this one. Have a feeling we'll probably be talking about this more in the days to come.
Absolutely, yeah. A story we've been watching and one Wells wants to hear about. Also, more Houston-Harris County news coming up just ahead on the show. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, with a reminder that November is Lung Cancer Awareness Month. A preventative regimen, including a healthy diet and exercise, can help prevent lung cancer. More at TexasOncology.com.
You've got it tuned to the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice. The top election official in Texas's most populous county is blaming the top election official in the state for causing an almost 12-hour delay in election results reporting this week. Harris County Clerk Diane Troutman says a last-minute order by the Texas Secretary of State caused the delay. She also says she believes the order was politically motivated. Zach Despart covers Harris County for the Houston Chronicle. He joins us now. Zach, thanks for coming on the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
What was this order made by the Secretary of State's office?
It was an election advisory that was sent on October 23rd. Now, it's not specifically addressed to Harris or any other county, but Harris County Clerk Diane Troutman and her staff interpreted it to mean that their method of reporting results on election night was impermissible under state law. So then they had to go to a backup plan that they say was the reason that it took 11 and a half hours, far longer than it normally does, to report results to the public.
So what was Harris County's original plan, and what did they have to switch to?
So Harris County's original plan was to use 10 sites around the county, since it's so spread out, to count votes in each of those sites. That would make it much more quickly, and then funnel those results back downtown to a single voting count location. Their backup plan, in order to comply with this Secretary of State advisory, was to bring all of the balloting machines from 757 polling locations to the single downtown location and count them there. And that's what they said made it take much longer.
Now, I know you mentioned this wasn't specifically targeted at Harris County. Why does the Harris County clerk think that this was politically motivated?
Well, it is still unclear entirely what the communication was between the Secretary of State's office and the Harris County clerk. The county clerk says that they had spoken with them at some point through the month of October. I called the Secretary of State's Director of Elections, Keith Ingram, to ask him about their side of the story. He referred me to a spokesman and hung up, so we don't have that side of it. This you sort of have to view in the whole context of how local officials in Texas cities, most of whom are Democrats, have long been skeptical that state government has tried to interfere in what they do and limit their authority. That, of course, was heightened last month when the tape of Speaker Bonin being critical of local officials came out.
Right.
So viewed through that lens, I believe that's part of the reason why Diane Trotman is thinking this perhaps could be politically motivated.
But the Secretary of State's office is saying, no, this was just about election security. Is that right?
Yes. What we did get from the Secretary of State is they sent us a letter that they had sent to State Senator Carol Alvarado, who had asked on Monday for clarification about what had happened here. And the state is saying that, look, Harris County should have known the law all along. This election advisory is not a policy change. It merely is a refresher to counties about, look, this is what our laws are that have been on the books that we have to follow. So Harris County should have no excuse for not knowing what the rules were.
Do we know why this seemed to affect Harris County so specifically? It obviously a very large county and lots of ballots to count, but did they just not get the information in time? Is that the accusation? I mean, why wasn't this a problem throughout the state?
So a couple of reasons. One, Harris County is the largest. Two, Harris County also had a mayoral election and city elections on Tuesday, so there was much more on the ballot, which means that the
greater
turnout was
higher. Yeah. Okay.
Than other places. Yeah.
And so I know that also Harris County recently moved to a countywide voting system, and this was the largest election under that new system. Is it possible that also contributed to problems, that maybe the Secretary of State's office isn't solely to blame?
Yes, that is the other key piece to think about here. This was, as you pointed out, the largest election that Harris County has used voting centers in. Of course, that is the plan, where voters can vote at any precinct on election day and not just the one where they are assigned. It's designed to make voting much more convenient for people who have work or school on election day. The Secretary of State gave Harris County approval to do this in May, or in the spring, and they first used it in an election in May. The weird quirk here, which we really don't have an answer to yet, is the Harris County clerk used this vote reporting system in that May election. And they say the Secretary of State signed off on that, never raised an issue with it. So it's still unclear why it was an issue in November.
Yeah, that's interesting. And this November was Diane Trotman's first election as the Harris County clerk. Do you see this scarring her reputation moving forward?
Well, again, it's unclear even now whose fault this was. I mean, Diane Trotman did speak with reporters for 40 minutes yesterday and acknowledged that this was not as smooth as they had hoped it would be. I mean, I think she has a lot of room to improve. And if she and her office is able to do that in future elections and perhaps is able to iron out whatever these issues are with the Secretary of State, I think the public would have a lot more confidence in that. But I think this single election is too soon to really draw a conclusion on that.
Zach Despart reports on Harris County for the Houston Chronicle. Zach, thanks again.
Thank you.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, whose workers' comp dividend program recognizes employers for striving to prevent accidents and helping to keep employees safe and on the job. More at WorkSafeTexas.com.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. Elsewhere in the state, other elections issues. Final results in Travis County weren't available until nearly 4 o'clock in the morning on Wednesday. Travis County Clerk Dana DeBeauvoir said in a press conference yesterday the delay was in part because of the county's new voting process. It reintroduces paper ballots, which confused some voters. DeBeauvoir says some people left with those paper ballots, so they didn't actually cast them.
Just like in any regular paper ballot election, if you take your ballot home, you have not voted. So these are 8 or 10 or, you know, a few, and it was only a few people, who learned some lessons the hard way.
Texas law says if 3 or more people leave a polling location without placing their paper ballot in a scanner, then all of the ballots at the polling location have to be re-scanned. 13,000 ballots from 15 locations had to be re-scanned in Travis County. DeBeauvoir says the law should change for the process to go more smoothly in the next election, and she says her office is going to work on doing a better job of educating voters on how the new ballot process works. Now, speaking of elections, if you were wondering about turnout across the state in general, consider this headline from the Texas Tribune. Half of registered Texas voters turned out in 2018. Just 12% turned out this year. Now, the Tribune admits that turnout in odd-numbered years has always been historically low. While this year's turnout is higher than in 2017, it is still pretty darn low. Meanwhile, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, announced this week it'll give $300,000 to a small tech company out of College Station. They say they make these molecule traps to produce clean energy in air, something the EPA can get on board with. We've got more news coming up just around the corner in the Texas Roundup. Stay with us.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Texas has more rural students than any other state in the country, according to a new report from the Rural School and Community Trust. Texas Public Radio's Camille Phillips has more.
The report, based on national statistics, found that nearly 700,000 Texas students attend a rural school. Nearly half of the school districts in Texas are rural. Compared to most other states, rural schools in Texas have less money to spend per student and lower educational outcomes. Alan Richard is a board member for the Rural Schools and Community Trust.
Many rural schools have wonderful things to offer. They give you personal attention and there are caring places where everybody knows each other. But too often, rural schools are made to struggle across the country.
The report is based on data from the 2016-2017 school year, before state legislators increased funding for public education. I'm Camille Phillips in San Antonio.
Dallas officials will be spending $60 million on emergency costs associated with a tornado that tore through the city on October 20th, severely damaging local infrastructure. The city council approved the funds Wednesday. Chief Financial Officer Elizabeth Reich briefed council members on a variety of costs, including uninsured losses.
The largest uninsured loss in the city is traffic signal and signage repair and replacement. That's about $30 million at this point in time. Again, preliminary estimates until we nail everything down.
9 other tornadoes touched down in other parts of North Texas on that same night in October. Texas health officials are conducting a statewide assessment of how to improve services for mothers and their children as part of a federal block grant. As Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner reports, that includes focus groups today in Clarksville in Northeast Texas.
The focus groups are made up of pregnant women and families with babies, parents of kids with special needs, and parents of teenagers. Health and Social Service providers providers are also surveyed. Jeremy Triplett leads the maternal and child health section of the Texas Department of State Health Services. He says focus groups are asked about their top priorities.
What are gaps with your own health or your family's health? And, you know, what resources do you need to sort of achieve optimal health within your family unit?
So far, Triplett says they've conducted focus groups in 23 cities around Texas, including Houston, Brownsville, and Midland. And the goal is to get to harder-to-reach areas like urban and rural populations. I'm Sasha Cordner in Houston.
The U.S. Drought Monitor reports 41% of Texas is experiencing drought, down from 46% of the state a week ago. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. Pop quiz time. Can you name the state insect? If you're scrunching up your nose at the very idea, don't. It's the monarch butterfly. Not bad, right? But you may have heard monarch populations have been in decline. They've dwindled by more than 80% in the past 20-plus years. One cause of death? Your vehicle. That's right, researchers at Texas A&M know millions of monarch butterflies die each year when they're hit by cars and trucks, but they're still trying to determine what can be done about it. Robert Colson is leading the effort. He's an entomology professor at Texas A&M. Professor Colson, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
First, we should clarify, we don't believe vehicle collisions are the only problem for monarchs. What else do we think is contributing to population decline?
Well, there are many factors involved in it. The fall migration starts almost in Canada and ends up in central Mexico. Various vicissitudes in weather, pesticide exposure are two of the major ones that are important. But the roadkill incidents, which we've recently identified to be important, is one that's been ignored and overlooked over the years.
Well, and you mentioned that Mexico to Canada trip and back every fall. Why is the journey back to Mexico especially risky for monarchs?
Well, the population begins to funnel, to narrow, as it reaches, comes into the into Texas, and then finally enters into Mexico. And as that migration corridor narrows, the population density becomes greater, and the impact that automobiles can have on that increases. And that's what is occurring in mostly in South Texas as the migration just about enters into Mexico.
How much, though, do we know about monarch vehicle deaths? It seems like it would be hard to study.
It's very hard to study because it occurs over very large spatial extents. Our surveys are conducted in three different areas in Texas, in the upper part of the state, the middle and the lower part, and it involves walking roadways and counting dead butterflies on the side of the road. It's not very glamorous work, and it takes a lot of time. We've done it in 2016 and 2019, and in those periods, we found very high incidences of road mortality, and we've estimated what that mortality means to the population of butterflies that actually gets back to Mexico, and it's a staggering number. About 4% of the population that actually arrives in Mexico was killed on their final phase of their journey.
You're working with the Texas Department of Transportation on this new round of research. Is there any shift in your focus, or what's different this time?
Well, we're working with the TxDOT Research and Technology Implementation Division, and they're interested in where the mortality is occurring, how much it's occurring, and eventually what sort of mitigation procedures could be implemented to reduce the mortality.
I mean, I think that that's the big question. It seems like a solution might be very complicated. I mean, you couldn't exactly build a bridge over an area and make room for butterflies to go through. Do you have any estimation of possible solutions?
Well, that's part of the research, is to do a thorough examination on various types of mitigation strategies that could be implemented. And that ranges from road signs to overpass bridges. We're not sure exactly which approach would be best for monarchs, and that's part of what we're trying to investigate to see what is possible and feasible to actually implement. So that's part of the research project that we're doing.
So how can regular folks help? I understand you're putting a call out.
Yes, ma'am. We would like to know more about where the mortality occurs. There are certain areas where the mortality is clustered, and we call those hot spots. So if Texas citizens can identify when they see one of these incidences where there's high, large populations of monarch butterflies being killed by vehicles, if they'll let us know where that is, then we can go investigate those sites and we can add that information to the database that we're collecting on how much and where the mortality is occurring. We think those hot spots reoccur in the same places each year, and it may be a function of wind funneling, of topography, of various kinds of geographic variables that enter into the equation of why the hot spots occur where they do.
Robert Colson is an entomology professor at Texas A&M. He's leading a new round of studies looking at the roadkill deaths of monarch butterflies. Professor Colson, thanks again.
You're welcome.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm Marika Flatt, travel editor with Texas Lifestyle Magazine, here with your weekend trip tip. You know, East Texas is often overlooked as a weekend vacation destination, but there's something beautiful and peaceful about the piney woods of East Texas that recharges your mind and spirit. Home of Stephen F. Austin State University, Nacogdoches is considered the oldest town in Texas. Amid the beautiful campus and the crunchy pine needles, NAC has a knack for welcoming visitors. Vintage and vibrant, the Fredonia Hotel offers an oldies feel with a super cool vibe. From the outside, you see the 1950s facade, and then you walk into the lobby full of striking lighting and posh fabrics. You really feel like you've stepped back in time. The Fredonia's First City Cafe offers savory dishes and delicious desserts. Start your day with an omelet built to order or the Lumberjack Breakfast, an ode to SFA's mascot. And another great option is Macklemore's Ale House and Bistro, or Max as the locals call it. It originally started as a class project. Max prides itself in offering a large craft beer selection and live music on the weekends. And locals come in for the gourmet stacked burgers and fried mac and cheese balls. Located just off a busy railway, Auntie Pasta's restaurant serves up some of the finest Italian food in East Texas. Start with their house-made fried cheese, and they'll bring you piping hot French bread in a bag. The ambiance is ideal for either a big family or a date night. In original downtown Nacogdoches, with its classic brick-lined streets, Dolly's Diner sits on the corner, ready to serve up generous portions. Dolly, with her colorful apron and knee-high socks, welcomes all with a smile. And like their menu says, it's not fast, not fancy, just good food. Sit on their old-fashioned bar stools and order funnel cake fries, a shake, or good old-fashioned float. And there's lots to explore in Nacogdoches. Enjoy a glass of wine at award-winning Red House Winery. This small winery features a tasting room and a relaxing patio. Meanwhile, the Heart of Texas Gift Gallery is a cute little store with the best selection of East Texas souvenirs. Make sure you say hello to Gracie, their official canine door greeter. And hiking trails around NAC are beautiful, shady, and full of pine trees. Try out one of the many parks around town, such as the Bonita Creek Trail or the SFA Interpretive Trail. Each will provide a shady path for walking or jogging. That's your weekend trip tip. I'm Marika Flatt for the Texas Standard.
Marika Flatt is travel editor of Texas Lifestyle Magazine. You can find more weekend trip tips at texasstandard.org. Well, our tech expert Omar Gayaga says he's a Lego man. By his own account, he's obsessed, and he became that way long after his own childhood in the 80s. He's written a sort of Lego true confession for Medium, and we wanted to ask him about it. Omar, thanks for stopping by the Texas Standard Studios.
Thank you for having me and my Legos.
Yes. What did you bring here?
I brought a set from the Overwatch line of Lego sets, and this one is Widowmaker versus Tracer. That's Widowmaker. That's
okay.
Tracer.
He's got a little lightning bolt thing on the back.
It's like a little spaceship that they're, that they're standing on. So yeah, this was one of the reasons that I got into Legos at this late stage of life. I didn't have them as a kid. My dad says I had Lego Lincoln Logs, mm-hmm. but no Legos, and I don't know if I just didn't ask for them or they just weren't around when in the stores where I was. But yeah, I never played with them as a kid. But now that I have daughters that are 12 and 9 years old, I've had that entree back into the world of Legos.
So your kids were your introduction, and then there's also this tech link, which, you know, fits with what you usually talk with you about with technology. So the Lego sets inspired by video games, and then also like Lego interactive video games. How did that work?
Yeah, a few years ago, right around the time the Lego movie came out, there was a Lego Dimensions, which was part of this wave of games that were sort of combining physical figures with video gaming, where you could actually take the figures and kind of import them into the video game. Disney did one called Infinity, and then there was Skylanders. But the one that really captured my imagination was the Lego one, because it mashed up all of these different worlds, like Ghostbusters and Powerpuff Girls and Batman, and combined them all into one video game.
So I have a confession. I did not really grow up being big into Legos either. I don't think I owned any. And when I did play with them, it was just like a bunch of colorful blocks that somebody had. And I would like put them on the little green mat grass thing and build a house, which is what I did every time, which maybe is why I wasn't that like excited about it. So it's the sets is what attracts a lot of people to Lego.
Yeah, I'm not a builder. I'm not good at like making stuff with my hands like that. But yeah, one thing that's really made Legos take off in the last 10, 15, 20 years is just these licenses with things like Star Wars and, you know, Overwatch and Minecraft, just all of these big pop culture properties that are already popular, and then making Lego sets out of them. I mean, Frozen 2 has this big blitz right now of all these new Lego sets. And that was kind of why my daughters got interested in it. My older daughter's a big Harry Potter fan, and she really got into the Harry Potter Lego sets. But then when you're a parent and your kid starts getting interested in these, you're like, these are really expensive. It's like $400 for the Hogwarts castle.
See,
it's ridiculous.
That I had no idea. I just did not think of Lego as like this big, expensive toy brand. But I guess it's when you're getting these sets with, I don't know, hundreds or thousands of pieces.
4,000 or 5,000 pieces. Wow. Yeah, they're huge. Like if you're going to do the Star Wars Death Star or the Hogwarts castle. And what I started doing, you know, because I am a parent and I am not made of money, was I started bargain hunting. I started looking on eBay and flea markets and these apps like OfferUp and Let Go, where people sell used stuff, trying to find deals on these expensive Lego sets. We even rented Legos. There's a service online you can actually rent
Legos.
Was
that fun? I mean, is that good to give it back? Or
It was, but you miss the whole experience of unboxing, and then you don't get to put the stickers on because they're already on there.
Oh, yeah.
And the site that we used had a very limited selection. It was a lot of older sets that were kind of out of date, so we couldn't get any of the newer ones. So, you know, it was a hit or miss, that experience. So we actually did a lot of bargain hunting. We chased down sets at flea markets. We bought stuff on eBay on discount. We waited for things to go on sale just to try to cut into the price of, because it's really expensive.
So what were your big takeaways from that bargain hunting? Like, what should people try to do? Now you're going to have competitors out
there. Yeah, when you go to the flea market and they tell you, this set is complete, like, don't, and it's used, like, don't believe them. Because we bought Hagrid's Hut, which is a very old Harry Potter set, and it was missing like 20 or 30 pieces, including Hagrid.
Oh, wow.
We had to go back and get Hagrid because they had it in a different place. So we had to go through this whole gray market of kind of these used brick sellers all over the world that will ship you, you know, whatever missing pieces of these old rare sets. And that took, you know, weeks. That took a lot of shipping costs and just getting these little packets from all over the world just to complete that one set.
Now, if I read your article correctly, it sounds like your daughters were into this with you, or at least one daughter in particular, and now you're kind of like
lone man on the Lego train in your house?
They're still playing with the Harry Potter ones, but what got me back into it in a big way where I was buying my own sets was this Overwatch connection, yeah. Was that I'm really into the Overwatch video game, and they started making these sets, and they're really nice looking sets, and they're really fun to put together. So yeah, I'm kind of hooked on that right now.
Well, and maybe it's not too late for me, or it's not too late for you if you are listening. When he's not building Hogwarts Castle or the Millennium Falcon from Lego bricks, you can find Omar Gayaga at techminutetexas.com. You can read more about his reintroduction to Lego at medium.com. Omar, thanks for coming clean about that Lego obsession.
Thank you, and you're welcome to play with my Lego set
right now. All right, I'll try not to break it.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU. Launching Lead On, a campaign for TCU. With a $1 billion goal to support people and programs striving to make a positive impact on the world. TCU, lead on. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at savenowforcollege.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice. Latinos make up 30% of the Texas electorate. They're an increasingly vital voting bloc in the state. Historically, Republican candidates have earned as much as half of the Latino vote in Texas, but times may be changing. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Trovall reports new data shows how anti-immigrant rhetoric may be alienating the state's Hispanic GOP voters.
Texas Hispanic voters are notoriously conservative compared to the rest of the nation's voting Latinos. However, there are signs that some Texas Latinos who once voted Republican are reconsidering. Pete Garcia is one of them.
I've been Republican all my life. You know, I started voting back when Reagan was in office. I hope I helped him get elected back then.
Garcia is executive director of the U.S.-Mexico Chamber of Commerce and says his political views are separate from his role at the chamber.
I can't say that I was really heavily favoring Hillary Clinton at the time, but it was there were not many options.
For the first time in a presidential election, Garcia broke from his party and voted for Clinton in 2016. Why?
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best.
Those comments not only hurt the illegal immigrants, but I know a lot of people that are from not only Mexican, but from Hispanic origins felt the same way that I did.
They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people.
Garcia blames Trump's rhetoric for racial violence, like what allegedly motivated the shooter who killed 22 people in El Paso. Garcia says he won't vote for Trump and predicts he's not alone among Latino Republicans. And there's some polling that says he may be right.
Things that repel the Latino community from the Republican Party tend to be issues involving immigration.
Brandon Rottinghouse is a political science professor with the University of Houston. His new research about Latino Republicans in Texas shows that hardline immigration talking points and policies hurt GOP approval among Latinos.
Republicans have counted on the support of about 30 to 35% of the Latino community in the past couple of decades, but those numbers are changing quickly.
A September Univision University of Houston poll shows that only 19% of registered Hispanics in Texas say they plan on voting for Trump. That could make Texas more competitive for Democrats.
I always say Texas is purple. Just because we don't have a statewide elected Democrat doesn't mean we're not purple.
Representative Will Hurd of San Antonio is the state's only Republican congressman who represents a border district. He says Republicans have a branding problem with Latinos.
I think we need to be changing some of the rhetoric and also some of the things that we support to make sure that we're competitive with the largest growing groups of voters. And I always say that if the Republican Party doesn't start looking like Texas, there's not going to be a Republican Party in Texas.
But state GOP leaders counter that they are doing a lot to appeal to Latinos. Texas GOP Chairman James Dickey.
We have been intentional in making sure that we have done great engagement efforts
through our staff, which is a third bilingual, over half minority and or female.
Dickey says he's not worried. Republican Governor Greg Abbott was reelected with 42% of the Latino vote in 2018. But Rodinghouse says Republicans should be cautious with their immigration message because it's not just Trump that alienates otherwise Republican-voting Latinos. It's also state and local officials.
Republicans in Texas are talking about border security issues in much more dramatic and sometimes offensive terms to Latinos, and that is definitely creating a wedge where they're less likely to support them than they were in the past.
In the last big statewide election in 2018, a surge in Latinos voting for Democrats was almost enough for Democrat Beto O'Rourke to defeat incumbent U.S. Senator Ted Cruz. But with the Latino population growing in Texas, their vote could prove pivotal for Democrats in 2020. I'm Elizabeth Trovall in Houston.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. And it's that time of the show where we check back in with social media editor Wells Dunbar. Welcome back, Wells.
Hi, Lauren. Good to be back. Well, you know, we were just talking about voting in 2020, and Julian Castro, he appeared on The Daily Show last night and threw some major shade at Mayor Pete Buttigieg while he was at it. I don't know if you had a chance to see the clip here, but pretty interesting stuff. Backstory here, Mayor Pete and former San Antonio Mayor Castro, they've been going at it on the campaign trail with Castro, most recently arguing Buttigieg's issues with police and African-American relations in his city didn't bode well for boosting black Democratic turnout. Mm-hmm. To that, Buttigieg said Castro should come down to Fort Bend and see how things are going himself. Well, he addressed that criticism on The Daily Show last night, Castro saying, "I don't need to go to South Bend. I visited 100 cities as HUD secretary and was the mayor of a city 14 times bigger." And now the twist in the knife here, he says, "In fact, we could almost fit South Bend in our Alamo Dome in San Antonio." Yeah, yikes.
Everything's bigger in Texas.
You know, you would think so. But it's interesting because I'm seeing a little bit of pushback for Castro on our Facebook page there. Philip White writes, "That's interesting because you could almost fit Castro's poll numbers in this South Bend,
Ouch.
Indiana souvenir spoon."
Oh,
yeah, and a little picture,
goodness.
You know, little spoons your grandma would collect.
Well, not nice to be mean to a whole city of Fort Bend just because you got a riff with the mayor, I guess.
It is,
you know?
like Indiana's like sixth
Am
biggest
Am I saying Fort Bend or South Bend? City? South Bend. Is it South Bend?
South Bend. I
keep
well,
going
you know,
back and forth.
It's not San Antonio.
No.
No, it's not.
It's smaller than
so,
that.
And you know, one thing that they addressed on the show was Beto O'Rourke, I think, appeared on The Daily Show like last week. And so that was the first thing out of Noah Trevor, the host's mouth. It's like, this isn't, you know, you're not going to tell me you're not dropping out. And then because Beto O'Rourke didn't tell me, he said he wasn't dropping out. And then 4 days later. whether or not The Daily Show is the curse for Texas politicians remains to be seen. Yeah. So keeping an eye on that, keeping an eye on a couple other stories we've been talking about on the show. The Daily Paper here in Austin, the Austin American Statesman, they tweeted out an interesting piece of news that the city's Chamber of Commerce, the Austin Chamber of Commerce, introducing a new initiative to raise $14 million by the end of the year to build and operate a temporary homeless shelter here in Austin by early 2020. Of course, homelessness and the conflict between the city and the state being continuing to play out. We saw TxDOT cleared these highway overpasses on the governor's orders. The governor tweeted out some photos on like before and after photos applauding the clear out of those camps. And he tweeted an interesting bit of news. He said, "Texas is providing the homeless with acres of area to camp and portable potties, hand sanitation and food all in one place for health workers to treat them." But I have, so far, I don't think we've seen any further details on what this actually entails.
Right.
If it's an actual state operation. And details haven't really been forthcoming. So that's another interesting...
follow up on that.
Interesting addendum we're keeping an eye on there. Another quick story, Chuck Lindell, also with Austin American Statesman, he tweeted that none other than Oprah is adding her star power to calls to delay Rodney Reed's execution. She appeared on CBS's
this morning and actually urged the governor to give another look at this petition 2 million people signed to stay the execution of Rodney Reed.
Yeah, facing the death penalty, but many say let's look at that case again, including now Oprah. What do you think? You can let us know on social media. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Yeah, I'm ready to do this again if you want to. If you start with the back announce.